The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Support for the Economic Club of Indiana is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025. Focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system. Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today's presentation is from John Lechleiter, Eli Lilly and Company CEO.
Over the 199-year history of Indiana, there has been no corporation more important to our state than Eli Lilly and Company. Today, Eli Lilly employs more than 39,000 individuals around the world and more than 12,000 here in Indiana. It has plants in 13 nations globally and markets its products to over 143 nations. Last year, Eli Lilly had revenues of $19.6 billion and net income of $2.3 billion. Over the last 5 years, Eli Lilly has more than doubled its stock price from $35 a share to, today, 80.83 cents per share. And that fact is due to the leadership, vision, discipline, and integrity of our speaker today, Dr. John Lechleiter, who is the president, CEO, and chair of Eli Lilly and Company. Dr. Lechleiter first joined the firm in 1979 as a senior organic chemist. He became the president and CEO in 2005 and was named its chair in 2009. During this past decade, John has guided Eli Lilly through an incredibly complex and fluid dynamic globally and nationally. He received his BA from Xavier University and master's and doctoral degrees from Harvard. He holds honorary doctorates from Indiana University, the National University of Ireland, Marion University, the University of Indianapolis, and Franklin College. He serves on the boards of Nike, Inc., Ford Motor Company, is a member of the American Chemical Society and the Business Roundtable, and locally is an advisor to the Children's Museum and serves on the board of the Fairbanks Institute, United Way, and Downtown Indy. John and his wife, Sarah, are also extraordinary citizens. They love Indianapolis. They love the state of Indiana. They are incredibly engaged in our community. Every city in America would love to have John and Sarah, but they cannot. We do. So we are so pleased to invite back to the podium the president, CEO, and chairman of Eli Lilly Company, Dr. John Lechleiter.
Thank you. That was very kind. Thank you. Well, Matt, thank you very much for that very kind introduction. Good afternoon, everybody. I want to thank the Economic Club for this opportunity to speak here this afternoon. Standing in front of this audience is a privilege that I do not take lightly. And I want to talk about three things today that I hope will be useful for all of you. First, I'd like to talk with you about Eli Lilly and Company and the path we have chosen, capturing both what we've been through in recent years and where I believe we're going. Second, I want to reflect on the role of Lilly and the biopharmaceutical industry in healthcare, speaking to the issue of drug pricing in particular, which has recently been the subject of some very public and often critical discussions. Finally, I want to share some thoughts and some challenges with this group on the role of business in the community, and on the evolution of Lilly's role as a corporate citizen, drawing from my personal experiences as CEO. As some of you may remember, this is my second address to the Economic Club. My first time was almost exactly 7 years ago, on September 24, 2008. I had become Lilly's CEO just a few months earlier, and you were kind enough to allow me to share an overview of our plans. I remember that occasion pretty well. On the same day, just a few hundred yards away, the roof of the RCA Dome was being deflated in front of crowds of people and news cameras. So I was a little concerned that no one would come listen to my speech, since I could not promise to bring the roof down over here. Well, actually, thinking back on it, that giant hiss of air escaping from a bubble was a metaphor for what was going on in the global economy at the same time. 9 days earlier, 9 days before I spoke, Lehman Brothers had filed for bankruptcy. 5 days later, the New York Stock Exchange experienced its worst session in more than 20 years, as $1.2 trillion of market capitalization vanished in a single day. Stock markets around the world would continue to plummet for weeks as central banks and governments hatched bailout and stimulus packages, trying to stay ahead of credit defaults and enormous investor anxiety. It was the scariest time for the world economy since the start of the Great Depression. It also was among the scariest times in the history of Eli Lilly and Company, and the challenges Lilly faced had a life of their own, quite apart from the financial crisis. We were about to drive over the largest patent cliff in the company's history and one of the worst ever faced in the pharmaceutical industry. As we look just ahead to the period starting in 2011, Lilly faced the prospect of losing patents on four of our largest products. In 2009, they accounted for nearly $9 billion in sales, fully 40% of our revenues, and an even higher percentage of our profits. We had to give this road trip from hell a name, so we called the period between 2011 and 2014 the years YZ. Some of you may remember that we called the period following Lilly's loss of the Prozac patent in 2001 year X, and we knew that what awaited us in 2011 would be even worse, requiring whatever letters remained in the alphabet. It's no more. The loss of patents accounting for 40% of revenues was bad enough, but on the other side of the equation, there were not enough assets in our late-stage research pipeline, at least as it stood in early 2008, to fill the gap. Certainly not in time to make up for the revenue losses. And that was before most of that late-stage pipeline went on to fail unexpectedly in clinical testing, right into 2010, it turned out. So we had our work cut out for us. It was going to be like building a bridge while crossing it, literally. In our approach to this challenge, the management team followed one guiding principle above all. We said we would take a long-term view and act accordingly. There would be no quick fixes. And so our response to the years YZ had three major components. First, we had to start rebuilding the bridge, our pipeline, in a way that would last. That effort began in earnest about 2 weeks after I spoke here in 2008, when we announced plans to acquire ImClone, a biotechnology firm with one oncology product, Erbitux, already on the market, and a promising late-stage anti-cancer pipeline. At a price tag of $6.5 billion, it was the largest acquisition in Lilly's history. We certainly got no points for timing. In the midst of the financial crisis, commercial credit markets essentially shut down the very week we announced the deal. But fortunately, we were able to use our strong balance sheet to get the deal done. We made other smaller acquisitions of specific molecules and technologies along the way. But most significantly, we did not shy away from making the necessary investments in our internal R&D. And we actually increased R&D spending each year leading up to 2014. During these years, Lilly's R&D investments as a percentage of sales have grown to some of the highest levels in an industry already known for massive research spending. You can see here that Lilly spent about $5 billion per year on R&D since 2010. That's the equivalent of paying for 6 Lucas Oil stadiums per year. To make these sorts of investments in R&D and to partially offset the huge revenue losses, we needed to run the entire company, including our labs and our clinical research efforts themselves, ever more efficiently, and to scale back on the size of our workforce globally. Without question, the second component of Lilly's response to the year's YZ was the most painful. Some of the early decisions changed our decades-old footprint here in Indiana. In 2008, we sold our Greenfield laboratories to Covance, and a year later, we sold our huge manufacturing facility in West Lafayette to Evonik, a German company. Fortunately, employment has been maintained in both locations. In late 2009, we also made a major change to Lilly's internal structure, creating separate business units that would take charge of our diabetes, oncology, and biomedicines product portfolios, and another that would focus on our entire portfolio in the emerging market countries. Elanco, our animal health business, already had been operating essentially as a separate business unit from its home base in Greenfield. The third and final piece of our YZ strategy was to drive growth in the products and geographies where opportunity lay during this difficult period. This led to a particular focus on Elanco, as well as on the emerging markets, China in particular, and on Japan, where products historically came on the market later and therefore did not face the same early patent expirations as the rest of the world. And each of them, as you can see here, came through in a big way. These growth drivers were key stabilizers of that bridge across years YZ. So my reflections here beg the obvious questions. Has Lilly completed that bridge we were building and trying to cross at the same time? And will the bridge hold? To answer these questions, let me refer to 3 obvious benchmarks: the condition of our business today, the current state of our research pipeline, and the trajectory of our stock price. Looking at our business, I'll start with animal health. Following our acquisition of Novartis' animal health business at the beginning of this year, Elanco today is a top 3 animal health player globally, anticipating $3.5 billion in revenue this year and a very bright future. Lilly Diabetes, which consummated a global partnership with Germany's Boehringer Ingelheim in early 2011, has launched no fewer than 8 products since that year and remains a strong engine for growth in a therapeutic category that Lilly quite literally invented here in Indianapolis nearly a century ago when we were first to manufacture insulin on a commercial scale. Meanwhile, our oncology business also is in what seems like continuous launch mode and could have as many as 5 or 6 products on the market by the beginning of the next decade, including our existing portfolio. And Lilly Biomedicines, our largest business and the one that bore the brunt of these patent expirations, has transformed itself and today is closing in on new treatments for patients who suffer from Alzheimer's disease, cardiovascular disease, psoriasis, rheumatoid arthritis, and several types of pain conditions. I likewise feel very optimistic about Lilly's future when I look at our pipeline. The chart I'm showing you here is a 1-page snapshot, we provide this every quarter to our investors, of Lilly's portfolio of products in development, going left to right from the first stage of clinical testing in people to final regulatory review before approval and launch. Now, inevitably, it slopes downward to smaller numbers on the right because many of these molecules will fail along the way. That's the nature of our business, I'm afraid. I could go through this chart story by story, since, in fact, every molecule on here has a story behind it, typically involving hundreds of Lilly people, many of them your neighbors here in Indiana. But let me simply focus on the headlines. What you see here is the strongest mid to late stage pipeline in Lilly's history by a wide margin. The strength is qualitative as well as quantitative. There are a large number of opportunities in this mix, and I believe they are also high-value opportunities, targeting diseases such as Alzheimer's that burden patients and healthcare systems around the world. Some of these molecules will, in fact, fail, as so many others have done in the past, but the depth of this pipeline is such that we should never find ourselves with fewer than 7 to 9 molecules in phase 3, the final phase of testing. Sustaining this kind of pipeline will require robust early-stage investments and myriad partnerships, so you will continue to find Lilly being highly active in business development efforts worldwide, involving academic partners, small biotechnology companies, and other large pharma companies alike. Turning to the final benchmark, say what you will about the cruelties of markets, at the end of the day, the stock price is the telltale measure of external confidence in a business. As Lilly approached its YZ crisis at the end of the last decade, our stock price reflected two things pretty clearly: the size of the challenges before us and the skepticism of many investors that Lilly's strategy would enable us to overcome our pipeline problems. But we've delivered on our strategy and put Lilly's R&D drought behind us. The market has responded in kind. Our stock price is up about 194% since our low in early 2009. While some investors might have assumed 6 or 7 years ago that we would disappear in a takeover, investors today rank Lilly's growth prospects near the top of the entire biopharmaceutical industry. None of this would have been possible without the dedication and hard work of the thousands of Lilly employees around the world. They are just the best. I was reminded of the correspondingly small part that I played when I recently met at a local civic event an elderly gentleman who had been following Lilly's fortunes. Commenting on my performance as CEO over this period, he said succinctly, "You certainly surprised many of us." It's a true story. So yes, we built the bridge while we were crossing it, and I believe that the bridge is strong enough to hold. And strong it must be, because today we do not want for fresh challenges. We face a new breed of competitors, larger pure-play biotech companies optimized to bring treatments in designated therapeutic areas to market very rapidly, as well as another breed whose business model is not to discover and develop new medicines as much as to acquire new medicines by swallowing up other companies that already did the R&D. There's also a new category of competitor coming from outside our industry entirely. Businesses such as Apple and Google are developing devices and digital applications that aim to fundamentally change the way patients with diseases such as diabetes are diagnosed and treated. Meanwhile, a number of important markets around the world, China and the U.S. are at the top of the list, are going through enormous changes where pricing, intellectual property, and market access issues are concerned. Drug pricing in particular has grabbed the headlines recently, so I want to spend a bit of time on this topic. As I speak about pricing, I want to share 3 basic qualifiers, things that rarely, if ever, get mentioned in media accounts of exorbitant prices for new medicines. First, the prices for medicines you see quoted in the media often don't get paid by anyone. As in most other businesses, our industry must negotiate with our buyers, typically large insurance companies or pharmaceutical benefit managers like CVS Caremark, the one that Lilly uses to manage its own employees' prescription drug benefits. They drive hard bargains so that the actual prices paid reflect significant discounts. And as the chart shows, health plans have many other levers to reduce spending on medicines. Second, What gives those buyers leverage, not unlike other businesses, is competition. And yes, there's plenty of competition in the pharmaceutical industry. Lilly aims for first-in-class breakthroughs, but it's ironic that our industry as a whole has been criticized for bringing products to market that are similar to others, so-called Me Too drugs. Well, that's exactly what begets price competition. In addition to offering patients a broader range of potentially effective treatments, as this chart shows, the median time between the appearance of the first new product in a class and the launch of its first competitor has shrunk dramatically in recent decades to a little over a year. And finally, never forget that we are one of the few industries that give birth to its own most potent price competitors. Of course, I'm talking about generic medicines. Without the initial breakthrough medicines, healthcare systems would not have the benefit a few years later of less expensive generic versions. And it's worth noting that almost 9 out of 10 prescriptions written today in the U.S. are for generics. The three things I just shared are important to keep in mind, but I'd still be the first to acknowledge that on the face of it, many new patented medicines are expensive. Their prices are high because they cost a lot to create in the first place and because they deliver a great deal of value. That value takes different forms depending on the nature of the innovation and the disease being targeted. It could be extra months and years of life. It could be fewer side effects as compared to older treatments. It could be an alternative to expensive and debilitating surgery. It could be the avoidance of disease. Think about the cholesterol-lowering medicines or medicines that help prevent osteoporosis. Or it could be an outright cure, eliminating what otherwise might be years of costly treatment and disability. All of these things provide tremendous value to patients. And they also tend to save money for the healthcare system as a whole. Unfortunately, many health insurance plans in the U.S., by their design, continue to mask much of the value delivered by medicines by forcing patients to pay a disproportionate share of their prescription drug costs out of pocket compared with other forms of care. Notwithstanding copay assistance often provided by pharmaceutical companies, patients today pay an average of 19% of the cost for medicines themselves, and often much more for cancer treatments and other specialty products, compared with about 5% of the costs for hospital charges. The resulting shocks at the pharmacy counter create the impression that medicines are the driver of rising healthcare costs, when in fact they've been among the few breaks on total costs over time. The bottom line is that medicines today remain a small portion of total healthcare spending. What's really costly, after all, is disease, particularly chronic disease, which accounts for 75% of what we spend on healthcare in this country. Modern medicines are not the problem, they are the solution. I share this with you to provide some context. The next time our company or another one stands accused of charging too much. But I also recognize it remains our industry's job, as it should, to deliver truly valuable new treatments for patients fighting diseases like diabetes, like cancer, like Alzheimer's, that still cry out for more effective care. Lilly aims to continue doing that from right here in Indiana, which is where I'd like to turn now. There's an old saying around town that I'm sure most of you have heard. When Lilly catches a cold, Indiana gets the flu. It's meant to convey the spillover effects of our downtimes on the regional economy as Lilly and its employees tighten their belts. Now, notwithstanding our recent experience, I thought for a long time that the saying exaggerates reality. In fact, I think it would be better for all concerned if we turn the old saying on its head. When Indiana catches a cold, then Lilly risks the flu. And not just Lilly, of course. I ask each of you to fill in the name of your business. And I challenge you to think of this relationship not only in economic terms, but much more broadly. Think about the quality of public education that kids can receive in central Indiana, starting with early childhood education before kindergarten, and ask yourself if that matters to the quality of tomorrow's workforce. Think about the quality of life in our towns and cities, cultural life, outdoor life, and spiritual life, along with the strength of our safety nets. Think about the condition of our roads and infrastructure. Ask yourself if those things matter in the decisions that you and other business leaders make about where to locate or whether to expand your operations. And think about the image of our state in the nation and in the world, our reputation as a welcoming and harmonious place. And ask yourself if that matters in your relationships with recruits and customers alike. Well, we've done these sorts of mental exercises at Lilly, and in almost every instance, the answer has been the same. These things do matter, big time. To put it as simply as possible, the health of our communities is a major factor in determining the health of our businesses. And much as I describe the guiding principle of our company strategy, we believe that it's essential to take the long-term view to help achieve community progress. At Lilly, that common sense realization led us to do a number of things in recent years to support local development, from a strong role in the Super Bowl bid to partnership in the Cityway project and the new YMCA to an active role in helping to launch the new Indiana Biosciences Research Institute. It led us to help broker a legislative compromise during the controversy earlier this year over the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, extending current protections for LGBT citizens for the first time in state law, and helping to restore Indiana's reputation, which I believe is a well-deserved reputation, as one of the most welcoming places in the world. It also led us to put up our own financial resources as matching funds and to take more of a hands-on approach than ever before to make sure that once and for all, disadvantaged children in Indianapolis have access to good quality pre-kindergarten programs. I'm very pleased to say that 80% of the $10 million pledged by Lilly and the business community towards pre-K has been raised, and the program is off and running in the new school year. Thanks to the commitment of Mayor Ballard, along with City County Council leaders Maggie Lewis and John Barth, it was a bipartisan effort of the kind we're led to believe is not possible anymore. Our intention in recent years is to positively influence community development and to help address other challenges outside our walls has led to a sharpened focus of our corporate foundation. Globally, we focused on health issues such as drug-resistant tuberculosis and diabetes, as well as funding Elanco's hunger relief work. Closer to home, here in Indy, we've directed a substantial portion of our foundation's resources to improving educational outcomes for disadvantaged children by supporting education reform, including, of course, the new pre-K program. Finally, I'm happy to report that Lilly is on the verge of putting in place a new agreement with our key community partner, United Way of Central Indiana, that will cement our long-standing relationship, expand the scope of activities between us, and create even greater community impact. Under the leadership of Ann Mertlow, our United Way has continued its transformation, begun by Ellen Anila, from a funder of community agencies into a true impact organization, developing strategies and focusing resources like never before on education, income, and health, along with basic needs. United Way today represents our best hope for positive change in our community. And as the fall campaign gets underway, I would ask everyone here to lend your full support to this effort. All of this is to say, as a corporate citizen, Lilly will not shirk from its duty to ensure that our Indianapolis and Indiana communities remain strong. In fact, we are stepping up our engagement. Our recent actions demonstrate that our involvement on occasion, will be forceful and direct. Particularly at this time in history, I happen to believe that this is appropriate and warranted for any of our businesses. As Brian Gallagher, the CEO of United Way Worldwide, commented to me recently, business by its very nature is pragmatic, and business is often in a unique position to solve problems at scale. Given what's at stake for our city and region, the involvement and engagement of business in the public commons has never been more important. Going forward, I urge even greater collaboration and cooperation between our business community, government, academia, and our strong not-for-profit sector in order to keep our Indiana home a vital, viable, and forward-looking place, competitive with the best and compassionate to the core. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for this privilege of speaking to the Economic Club of Indiana for a second time. I can sum up what I hoped to leave you with in a few words. Lilly built itself that new bridge while we crossed it. If we caught a cold along the way, we're over it. And Indiana did not get the flu. Things are pretty healthy here, yet our city and state can get better still if businesses step up as hands-on partners with each other and with the rest of the community. And let me say that Lilly's new bridge was but one more feature on a long path. The path we have chosen at Lilly remains in many ways the path marked out by Colonel Eli Lilly and his family beginning almost a century and a half ago. It's a path to scientifically validated breakthrough medicines for patients with difficult diseases. It's a path bounded by our values of integrity, excellence, and respect for people, which the family itself laid down. The path we have chosen at Lilly is bound up inextricably with Indiana, this place we are from and have always called home. And I believe we have something special here in Indiana. I'm glad that Lilly can continue to be part of it, stronger now and ready for the future. I'm lucky that I have been able to be part of it alongside all of you, and I'm grateful for your interest in what I've said here today. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, John, for that just absolutely terrific talk. For those of you who have questions, again, feel free to tweet them to us or hand them on cards. I see several of them are on their way. But John is willing to stay here for a few more minutes, and so I'll ask the first question, which is, where is the next Eli Lilly company coming from in Indiana?
Well, it's a good question, Matt. I think through our participation in BioCrossroads and the Biosciences Research Institute, we're certainly trying to seed to make sure that we create the environment here in Central Indiana where another would-be Lilly can form and thrive and grow. That requires a lot of things. It requires supportive government. It requires talent. So we need to be obsessive about keeping some of these bright kids that come to Indiana to go to college. It requires capital. So we've been working, obviously, to try to attract more venture capital funding here as well. And I'm the biggest cheerleader for this. I think that Lilly will be stronger when we have a more even more competitive local environment. And I have to say I'm pleased, you know, with the environment that we have here now, or I could say the healthcare sector, which nobody knows better than David Johnson, whether it's Lilly, Dow Agro, Roche Diagnostics, Cook down in Bloomington, the orthopedic companies up in the northeast part of the state. We have, depending on how you count, the second or third biggest state export market for healthcare in the United States. So we have to keep in mind while we have a lot here now, we can't simply rest on our laurels. We need to make sure we're creating opportunities for new businesses to form.
Thank you. Here's a good question. Will you run for president in 2016?
What do you think, Sarah? No. No.
Governor?
Nope.
Coroner?
What'd you say?
Nothing. What specifically compelled Eli Lilly to be so forceful in your opposition to the RFRA legislation?
Well, first of all, when the legislation was being debated before the RFRA had passed the first time, we stated our opposition to this legislation in the process of the hearings that were held. And one of our concerns was that this legislation could be used or cited by someone who, in effect, wanted to discriminate against someone, based on their sexual orientation or gender identity. But nobody, we didn't anticipate, I'm not sure anybody anticipated the firestorm that grew up around that. I think the motivation for us to partner with numerous others to urge legislators and the governor to get to the point where we had the so-called fix the following week was in large measure response to the firestorm of criticism that took place on the global stage and our concern that this was really hurting Indiana, our reputation and our ability ultimately to hire and recruit and retain talented people here to this region. That was the basis for our engagement.
How can we as a country control the rising costs for those who are on Medicare?
Well, I think there's sort of two parts, maybe more than two parts to that question. I think that as we look at our major entitlement programs, Medicare and Social Security, and there are others, there's a day of reckoning coming. This is just mathematics. More people going into those programs, living longer, drawing more from those programs, which we've all paid into, and in essence, not enough money to sustain those over a long period of time. Paul Ryan, in particular, has been talking for 10 or more years about this problem. And it's going to get worse. The calculations will get worse if interest rates start to rise. But that's another story. So I think as a country, we've got to come to grips with this. And I don't know when or how that's going to happen. But that's an issue that's an issue of national concern, not an issue just of Lilly concern. I think with respect to our part of Medicare, the medicines, since 2005, we've had Medicare Part D. Prior to that, many seniors were concerned about their ability to pay for medicines, in some cases out of pocket. Part D has been much more successful than anybody could have predicted in terms of costing much less than had been forecast and providing most seniors with fairly comprehensive drug coverage for a fairly modest premium. So if there's a government program in health that I can point to with solid data now, about 10 years worth, that seems to be working even better than planned, it would be Medicare Part D. And, you know, when you think about it, in the 1960s when Medicare was put into place, medicines weren't so much a part of health care. I mean, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s saw the advent of all these new medical breakthroughs in our industry. So it's only natural, I think, to think about a healthcare program like Medicare having a drug benefit, but it wasn't until 2005 that we had that.
What other countries have a better regulatory process than the U.S., and would the U.S. be moving in that direction?
I think the U.S. has probably the best regulatory process, all things equal. I mean, the FDA takes a lot of criticism. Certainly, there are always going to be matters. And any of you who work in a regulated industry, you're always going to have certain criticisms that you level at your regulators. But I think the U.S. FDA, I think, is still viewed worldwide as the gold standard. The Europeans have a very workable, functional regulatory system. Japan has probably made the most significant changes in recent years for the better, speeding up drug reviews and doing a number of things that have enabled Japan to sort of close what had been a drug lag over there. China's regulatory system is still in fairly early stages of development, but it's progressing, and they are seeking to learn from others, including the FDA.
It's a nice transition to this question. Can you comment more on your business in China?
Yeah, today our business in China, it's an important business, but it's a small fraction of our total sales. Although Lilly first came to China in 1918, it was actually the first foreign country that we entered after the United States. We didn't come back to China until 1993, so we were a little later coming back to China than many of the European companies, so our business today in China is a little bit smaller than theirs. But when I talk about the long term, China is a good case in point. We're in China for the long term. I think what we're seeing now is some of the inevitable bumps in the road as the Chinese economy continues on an almost sort of miraculous journey that started in the late 1980s, but I don't think which anyone could have expected was going to continue to grow at double-digit rates for 30 or 40 years. So we're in China for the long haul. We have research in China. We have manufacturing in China. We have the second highest number of employees in China as we do in any country outside the United States.
And for our last question, can you comment on the drugs that are in the process for Alzheimer's?
Well, how long do you have? Well, I'm proud to say Lilly really leads in this space. We have the most advanced clinical candidate today, an antibody in essence that sort of attacks or goes after these beta amyloid, which is the key building block for these plaques that form in the brains of people who are diagnosed with Alzheimer's. We'll have data on that drug by the end of next year. We also have a number of other drug candidates in development, some of which target this amyloid and others that target something called tau, which is another protein, or another misfolded protein, I guess you could say, that's found in the brains of people with Alzheimer's. There's still a lot of debate, Matt, about what really does cause Alzheimer's. So if any of our studies are successful, we'll not only have a potential drug candidate, but I think we'll shed a lot more light on the biochemical pathway, and I expect that will open up even more research. It's exciting. It's high risk, but it's exciting. Thank you all very much.
You've been listening to a speech from John Lechleider, Eli Lilly and Company CEO, part of the 2015-2016 Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series. Join us next month at this time for a speech from filmmaker, author, and mountaineer David Brashears. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Public Media in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thank you for joining us.